This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today's the big day for political junkies. The first time actual preferences will be tallied and candidates officially supported by actual American citizens in the Iowa caucuses. The whole shebang kicks off as Iowans gather in their precincts to support the candidate they feel most strongly for and to cajole undecided voters to join their ranks. It's going to be a big night, and VPR's live coverage will start at 9 p.m., so be sure to tune in. But if you're still scratching your head about exactly what a caucus is and why Iowa's first, or why all the states vote at different times, or how those big nominating conventions in July actually work, consider this show your primer. I'm excited for this program because it's going to be a great civics lesson, not to mention a little bit of a history lesson, and don't we all want to be better informed? So let's just go ahead and get started. I'm joined in the studio by Hank Eaton, who teaches advanced placement government and politics at St. Johnsbury Academy. Hello, Hank. Nice to have you here.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
And on the phone with us is Michael Hanahan, lecturer of political science at UMass Amherst. Hello, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Let's jump right in with the difference between a primary and a caucus. This should be a simple one to do away with because we've been hearing a lot about this. Most people, I think, know. But Hank, quick differences between primary and caucus.
Well, I think it's fascinating to look at a primary, which is a direct vote, which is what we're used to here in the East anyway, and a caucus where people are gathering in literally in people's homes and then at a larger level later on. And so there's a bit of convincing allowed, which some of my students might tell you they aren't too comfortable with being Vermonters because they feel like it's there's a possibility of undue persuasion there. So,
not to mention having to politically declare who you're supporting,
absolutely.
Or publicly, rather.
Publicly, exactly. It does away with the private ballot aspect. So fascinating differences. Also, I'm sure we'll get into later in the program whether they really reflect public opinion as well as a primary or not. That's another major issue today.
But Hank, shouldn't your students be very comfortable with that idea, given that we have town meetings here where you stand up in front of your neighbors and support things or agree to disagree?
Yeah, but the budget itself is actually voted on by Australian ballot. So your actual vote is secret. Your opinion about what to do is public.
But in St. Johnsbury?
At any town meeting. Nearly all town meetings have a private vote on the actual budget. So you go up and put your ballot in the box as opposed to a voice vote for other items. So I think when it comes to politics, students like to keep themselves and their opinions a little more guarded. And so it makes them nervous to talk about the caucus system.
Michael Hanahan, do you know how many states caucus or still caucus versus how many hold primaries where you do have a secret ballot?
I don't know the number off the top of my head. The primaries dominate. There's, you know, few caucuses and a lot of primaries. In some states, I think Nevada is one of them, have one party does a caucus and the other party does a primary.
Well, in Kentucky, I think, is like that, too. They have the Republicans have a caucus and the Democrats have a primary.
I think it's worth noting as a comment on the, as a follow-up to the first question, it sort of is, how do you look at democracy? The notion of a primary is actually pretty new. They're not that old. They've really grown a lot even since the 60s. Even as late as 68, most delegates weren't chosen in primaries. It's kind of, is democracy just when you go and vote based on what you see on television or read the paper? Or is democracy supposed to be a little uncomfortable, where you go and face people and listen to arguments? Those are two legitimate views of democracy, I think. I'd also say that my guess is the vast majority of people that go to a caucus in Iowa, I mean, how many people go to a caucus and aren't already decided? You know what I mean? I mean, in other words, these are people who don't have a problem declaring for their candidate. That's, in fact, why they're going. So I suppose there is some persuading going, especially if there's a third candidate that drops out and they huddle in a corner and the other people try to convince them to vote with them. But for the most part, these are people who have sort of predetermined to say how they're going to feel.
Right. As we've seen with the candidates really working hard to try to get their supporters out, because if their supporters don't come out in the snow tonight, they're not going to have those people who are in their corner and who are trying to pull any of those candidates, as you said, who don't get 15% of the vote in the original voting process. Then they do have to find somebody else to go caucus for. So I suppose that's where the debating or the cajoling comes in. Let's talk about a couple more details. So not all states hold their Republican and Democratic contests on the same day. How did Iowa and New Hampshire, though, secure their spots as the first caucus and then the first primary? Do you know, Michael Hanahan?
It's mostly history. Yeah, no, that's a sort of an inadequate answer. I think the answer to a lot of things in politics is why we do things is because that's the way we do things.
Mm-hmm.
And also Iowa, there's another reason, too. It's sort of circular. Once Iowa and New Hampshire had done their primaries and caucuses first, they became very aggressive at saying they would move their caucus and always be first. I think it's even in a law in
mm-hmm.
one of the states. And so what happens, of course, is politicians in the national parties and people who are potential candidates, they don't want to make the voters of New Hampshire and Iowa angry in case someday they decide to run for office themselves or allies of someone who wants to run for office themselves, and it's difficult to change it.
Hank Eaton, when you talk to your students, I imagine one of the questions is, why don't we just all vote on the same day? Why don't we have one day that's primary day and we all get to decide together?
Yeah, we actually do handle that. We're about to shift into that unit next, since it's right about election time. One of the big criticisms is that our voter turnout is low because we're always at the polls in America. One of the solutions that the students read about is the idea of a national primary or regional primaries that are rotated every 4 years, where, say, you have the eastern region go first 1 year, the Midwest first 1 year, the West 1 year. So one of the issues that they debate as part of their course of study is which of the solutions to our current system would be best. Because in actuality, one of the problems that we talk about is the number of people who turn out, not necessarily actually at election time, because our turnout has been better in 2008 and 2012, but in the nominees can be nominated with only about 20% of the vote. And that, for my students, is, you know, they have a very strong sense of fairness, and they don't like the idea that 20% of the voters in America choose who gets to run for office. So they actually proposed just now this morning, they're at a state competition for We the People, the Citizen, and the Constitution, which is a congressional hearing competition. And one of the solutions that they posed to the panel of judges this morning was to have a national holiday. So they feel that they're very concerned with voter turnout, particularly for their peers, 18 to 24, as we all know, as the lowest voter turnout. And they, of course, are passionate about politics. That's why they're taking the class. They would love to solve this problem.
So do they see it as, I mean, some of the states still have nominating contests in June, and as we look historically back, often the contests are fully decided by then, with weaker candidates dropping out and advising their supporters to support one or the other candidates who's still in the race. So do they see states like California, which votes in June, as just basically any voter there is disenfranchised, even though they have hundreds of delegates?
It's fascinating you ask that question. One of my students from Hawaii answered one of the judge's questions with his own experience, claiming that Hawaiians are at a huge disadvantage in the national election because they already have seen what's gone on beforehand. In essence, the way we do it.
You mean even on general election day?
Right, in the general election day, right, that they're the last to vote because of the Hawaii time is so much later. So to them, the issue is absolutely March. You know, we have 12 Democratic primaries on March 1st and 14 Republican primaries and caucuses, which is nearly a third of all the delegates you need to win on one single day, which is actually closer to your national election idea. And then on the 14th, there's another chunk of 800 or 900 delegate votes available. So I think we're moving closer to that. But the states having control over elections is something I think that we study a lot. And I personally am a little bit more wedded to the states having some control.
Listeners, we're talking today about all the details that go into how a presidential candidate is chosen by the party here on the day of voting in Iowa, caucusing in Iowa. Listen, if you have a question about how this all works, we're going to talk about delegates next, and we're going to get into what happens at the nominating conventions in July in just a few moments. So any questions that you have about how this whole process works, maybe you're trying to scratch your head and remember back to your civics lessons in high school or college, now's a good time to call 1-800 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. All right, so let's start to go into the delegates issue here. And Michael Hanahan, it's not like we tally the votes or compile all of the support and just award the nomination to the highest vote getter from all the states that have been voting for the last, you know, 4 months in June and July. Can you tell us what happens to the votes after each of the nominating contests? And don't get us as far as the conventions. We'll get to that. But just what happens to those votes immediately after they're counted?
You mean what happens to the people? There's usually every state party, Republican and Democrat, have some method of choosing who is a delegate.
Exactly. Explain what the delegates are. Because so if we all vote in our primaries and those votes are tallied and it shows 70% support for one candidate, 30% support for the other, what happens to those votes? How do they sort of get assigned to delegates?
Well, some states, the party just picks the delegates. And how many delegates a state gets, it depends on whether you're in the Democratic or Republican Party. So, for example, the Republican Party uses a formula based on population, of course, but also on the percentage of Republican presidential vote in the last election. You know, so a state like Alabama gets additional delegates because it's a strong performing Republican state. The Democrats have a more have an approach that attempts to balance the groups of people within the Democratic Party. So there's certain rules about percentages of people from different groups in that. Some states, the candidates will run delegates of voters. So if a state, for example, gets allocated a formula of 20, there might be different slates. Some states, though, there's 20 delegates, and those people are pledged to vote for the candidate that wins that state on the first ballot at the convention, even if they don't maybe particularly like the candidate in some ways. And, of course, it's even more complicated than that. What you're really watching today in Iowa, and I wish you would have had this conversation tomorrow because then we'd look a lot smarter, is they're really not electing the delegates today. What they're really doing is electing the delegates who will represent candidates at the state convention in Iowa. And then the state convention will then nominate the delegates for the national convention. Now, the two things are closely related, but I know there was some shift in votes between Obama and Clinton in the last election.
Yeah, and boy, it does get complicated because even when you look at how then the delegates are supposed to be divided, the Democratic Party generally uses a proportional system, so the delegates are split according to the percentage of support a candidate gets, but the Republicans do it differently, and they allow the states to decide whether they want to do a proportional system or an all-in, and all the delegates go to the
right
one who's actually had the most support. So it just, I mean, how did we even get such a convoluted system in the first place? Hank Eaton just talked about states' rights. But Michael Hanahan, is that what it is, that each party decides and then each state decides as well?
Let me defend it a little bit. You know, complexity in and of itself is not a criticism. It's just complex. And there is a feeling among people when they see things they don't really understand is they just want to say, it should be more simple. But you know, the real question is, what is a nomination as opposed to an election? And a nomination is really the political party, which is a free association under the Constitution, although it is very heavily invested in state regulation. Who do they want to nominate? And the question is often, I want somebody who's going to win, which historically was probably the number one question. But some people say, I want somebody who represents what I consider to be the views of the party. That would be someone that may be more conservative on the Republican side or liberal on the Democratic side. And so traditionally, the answer to that question is small groups of people who are professional politicians have generally met in small bodies and chosen who's going to get the delegates for that state. And they generally pick people they thought would be a good candidate for the national convention. In the 60s, and even as far back as the Progressive Era, but it really took place in the 60s, the question became, well, we shouldn't have these small groups of people choosing the nominee. We should have primaries so more people can participate. But I think what you've found to some extent is you still don't have particularly high participation, although some, but you all can also have the danger of getting a more out there candidate.
Our number, if you have a question, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And let's go to Peter, who's calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I've been having this conversation with friends lately, and no one seems to know the answer. Maybe you do. If a candidate gets enough delegates to have a nomination, but the party doesn't want them or doesn't like them, does the party have to support this person?
Peter, thanks for the call. Hank Eaton?
That's a complex question. I agree with Michael that complexity actually is the way our system is designed. In essence, on the Democratic side, in any case, 2,383 delegates will, in theory, get you the nomination. But the fact that the Democratic Party reserves superdelegates might mean, for instance, in 2008, Senator Obama, now President Obama, appeared to have the most number of delegates gained through the caucus and primary system. However, he didn't have enough to gain the full nomination at that point. The superdelegates actually could have swayed that election if they chose to. They chose rather to go with what they considered the voice of the people. So, in fact, it is possible that the party apparatus can still make the decisions at the convention.
Well, and let's pause here. Superdelegates are unpledged delegates, so they are not beholden to what a state vote is.
Right. That's what how they define them actually on the party websites and so on as unpledged. But in essence, those superdelegates who are the party insiders, Democratic National Committee members, members of Congress, governors, et cetera, some have already come out and pledged. So unpledged is the way they define them, but they do pledge themselves.
But even if they pledge themselves, let's say I'm a superdelegate and I say publicly, I support this one candidate legally, I could change my mind at the convention, right? If I am an unpledged superdelegate.
Absolutely. Just like an electoral college voter. In 1988, one of our electoral voters voted for Lloyd Benson instead of Mike Dukakis, for instance. So it would be similar.
And the pledged delegates, are they beholden by law to support the candidate who their voters chose? Or, you know, in the case of Iowa, you vote and then you send delegates to the state convention and then they send those delegates to the national convention. But do they have to stick with the popular vote?
I'm not a specialist there. I'd defer to Michael down there in Massachusetts. But
well, it's easy to get caught up in the notion of law. You know, if somebody all of a sudden is pledged to Donald Trump from Alabama and then it came to be the you know, generally what would happen is whoever the Alabama chief of delegate is, they would simply declare the voters of Alabama have chosen Donald Trump. And then on the second ballot, which hasn't happened for a long time, but if it did, then people are free. You know, the vast majority of things actually happen because of sort of habit and rules, not necessarily law. In other words, nobody's going to get arrested for it. I doubt if it could even be challenged in court. But that's sort of protocol and convention is that your state's first ballot will be for allocated for whatever rules your state has.
And Michael Hanahan, when you talk about Donald Trump, the Democrats have these superdelegates. We often talk about them. Do Republicans have any unpledged delegates?
You know, I don't think so. I was thinking about that when he said it. I thought it was just a Democratic thing, but I'm honestly not sure. The Republicans might have automatic delegates.
You know, I'm relieved to know that even the experts here find well, some of this a little bit convoluted.
I can jump in a little bit. The Republicans do have 40% of their delegates are like members of the RNC and so on. So the Republicans do have not as formal a structure.
And they don't call them superdelegates.
No, they do call them unpledged, though. Yeah.
Yeah, they call them. They don't know why the Democrats call their superdelegates. And the Republicans generally have, I mean, from my memory, and I used to be in sort of an administrator in the Republican Party, there's three per state. There used to be three unpledged delegates in each state, which would be usually the state chairman and the two RNC committee members.
And they would be basically, they go to the convention and they can support whoever they want.
Right. They don't have to run for office, in other words. They don't have to. They're automatic delegates, and they don't have to get elected.
We're talking today about what some might call a crazy process of nominating presidential candidates. Our guests today support the complexity. They say this is the system that we have. This is how it's designed. What do you think, and what questions do you have? Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit more deeply about what happens at the nominating convention. There are two conventions coming up in July. We're going to have the Republican convention, and we'll have the Democrats convening as well. So what questions do you have about how the nominating process actually works? Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're getting a solid grip on how the presidential nominating process works, from today's Iowa caucuses all the way to the party conventions this July. We're talking with St. Johnsbury Academy AP Government and Politics teacher Hank Eaton and UMass Amherst political lecturer Michael Hanahan. And we'd love to know what questions you have, maybe about how the superdelegates work. Was that clear to you? Or can a delegate who's pledged to Hillary Clinton change his or her mind at the convention? We're going to also talk now about what happens at those conventions and how the final processes go. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Joe wrote to us and says, I'm curious as to why there haven't been suggestions to have everyone allowed to vote on both parties' nominees in the primaries. It might help to break up some of the polarization and force candidates to the center and prevent extremes in one direction or another. As you said in the conversation, only 20% of the population may come out to vote. So why not make it more appealing by giving more people a say in both primaries? And Michael Hanahan, in fact, some states do that or have in the past allowed people to vote in more than one primary, but most states require you to either be registered with a party to vote in that primary or pick a ballot on the day of the primary, right?
Well, in California, there was such an attempt to do that, and it was ruled, I believe it was ruled unconstitutional because parties are considered associations under the First Amendment, so they have a right to association. And, you know, one right of association is to define who your members are. And another right of association is to define what you stand for. So if you stand for something, and I think it's important that the parties, Democratic and Republican, do stand for something because that's how people organize their minds in the electorate, then having anyone vote for them sort of takes away their ability to do that. In some ways, what that really is a suggestion for is just to abolish the party system and just have an election. Which a bunch of people running have no party affiliation.
They just and sounds like you don't think that's a good idea, Michael?
No, because I don't think in practice it would work. I mean, what's even happened in a few states is what happens is the other party organizes to vote for the worst candidate on the other side, you know, in order to hurt them to some extent. You get some strategic voting like that. So the parties just totally lose control of who their own representatives are. And in that case, they've really ceased being a political party.
Although you could say that that's what happens even in a state like Vermont, where we have an open primary system where you do have to choose a ballot on the day of, but you don't have to be registered with one party or the other. So in theory, you could go and cast a ballot for the party that you hate, hoping to strategically sort of set a bomb off.
Yes, but I took the listener's question to be letting people vote in both primaries at the same time.
Let's go to another call here, Alan in Burlington. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Jane. It's great to have some professors and teachers in the room for this. One of the things, and this is related, I think, to the previous question just now, I've always understood political parties to be essentially clubs or associations that get together to try to bolster their own people's chances of getting elected. But you don't have to be in a party in order to get on a ballot in most states. I just wonder, even fundamentally, why do the states underwrite, fund, and administer these private organizations' primary elections or caucuses at all?
Alan, thanks for the question. Hank, you want to tackle that?
Well, I'm not sure that the states actually underwrite the parties. The parties underwrite the parties in this way. And unlike Europe, where you actually have to pay dues, and therefore the people are pledging a more consistent commitment to the party. In the United States, you're just a member of the party because you say you're a member of the party. That doesn't mean you actually even have to vote for that party when you go into the booth. Thus, I think probably the importance, as we talked earlier, that my students place on the privacy of your vote. So I really don't, from my perspective, I don't think the parties have a lot to do with that. The last caller's question was intriguing to me in that in the primaries, generally you have your impassioned partisans vote. Those are your 20%. And in the general election, you have a mixed bag. And so it's very difficult to be a nominee who has to appeal to impassioned partisans. And then in the general election, you have to appeal to the center. Most political science studies tell us most people in the country, 41%, declare themselves as independent. So there's a disconnect between the nominating voting in the primaries and the caucuses and the general election. So there is a disconnect there. And what to do about that, I think, is an important question.
Let's go to Julie, who's calling in from Fairfax. Hi, Julie. Go right ahead.
Thanks, Jane. This is interesting. I think I got the answer to my question, but I have a second one. My first question was, if you're at an Iowa caucus and your guy or woman doesn't get 15% and everyone's trying to convince you to switch to someone else, can you just say, yeah, thanks, but no thanks, and go home?
And the answer is yes, right? You can go home.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. The person who answered the phone told me that, so that's kind of interesting. But really, what is a brokered convention? The Republicans talk about if Donald Trump looks like he's going to win, they're going to broker their convention. What is that? What is that?
Julie, I'm so glad you took us to the conventions. That's where I was hoping we'd go next. Michael Hanahan, what's a brokered convention?
Just real quick, I want to address the previous caller's question. He really, I think, was asking why do states pay for the management of primary elections if they're private affairs, you know, which is a good question.
Right, because these are run by secretaries of state if you're having a primary.
I think it's just the historical development of it. A lot of things in the U.S., things have just worked out that way. And, you know, the parties do control the states, the Democratic and Republican Party. So they do sometimes arrange things for each other's benefit, even though they oppose one another. That was a good question. A brokered convention, the closest we've had, I think, recently is probably the Nixon-Ford convention. Most of the time, as happened with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, Clinton realized she didn't have enough delegates, so she simply released all of her delegates to make it unanimous for Obama sometime well before the convention, although maybe not well before, but closer than it's happened in the past. A brokered convention is a convention where no one has 50%. So you can imagine, you know, candidates A, B, and C, and there's a vote, and nobody comes out with 50%. So then it just is, it's all open, and people begin to negotiate, trade, make promises. I think, you know, for example, Lincoln was like 13 or 14 votes, maybe more than that, before he was finally elected, and the management of that was, as you can again imagine, very chaotic. So basically, a broker convention is when nobody gets 50% on the first ballot.
And Michael Hanahan, as you mentioned, at that point, all of the delegates are released from their pledges and they're free to just vote their conscience. So does that become a time when who your delegates are becomes really important?
What really matters is how good your floor managers are. You know, what really matters is if you know if you want to get the 50%, what do? You know, there's a lot of bargaining strategies. If maybe the person third still thinks they can win, so they want to hold their delegates. And generally, your floor managers go around and tell people what to do. Hold, we're trying to cut this deal. We're trying to change the platform in this way. You know, we want this for Mississippi. Et cetera. So I think who your delegates are probably less important than who your operatives are.
Well, Hank Eaton, maybe you can just spend a minute here then and describe what's happening because, you know, most of us don't ever get to go to a convention, a nominating convention. So what is generally happening? How does the organization work?
Well, I can't say that I've been to a convention myself, so I'd probably refer to Michael, who's been on the inside of that for this.
All right,
question.
Michael, you take it then.
Well, I mean, generally, a convention's the ones that we've seen on TV. Anybody, you know, I'm 56. I'll give away my age there, but are sort of they're shows, and you start the roll call of Alabama. I think is first, and Wyoming's probably last, and then Alabama makes a big show about what Alabama is, and then casts all their votes for the nominee, because before the convention has even started, you know who's got the most votes. So conventions largely right now are about arguing about the platform and about making a good show for your party so you get a bump. But there is certainly the possibility that three candidates make it all the way through the process, or four, I think there's 50 people running on the Republican side. So, and what if those candidates all have some strength? What if they nobody has a majority and they're fairly close? Then on the first ballot, no one's going to win. I think one, during the Prohibition era, I think there was an election that had like 102 ballots.
Wow.
So political scientists every year love to talk about this because they get bored with their jobs and they just want something unusual to happen like that.
So that's why there's all of this talk of a brokered convention with glee you hear.
Yeah, and the journalists share the same interest in, you know, the train wreck.
Hank Eaton, you're teaching your AP Government and Politics class right now. It must be fascinating for your students to be learning about all of this, learning some history, but also learning how the process works, how we have set up all of these systems, and then watching it kind of unfold in real time, too.
Yeah, I think the most fascinating thing for the students is to study political science theory on the one hand and then see how it's applied. And what they generally find out is what Michael described quite a bit earlier in the show, and that is our system is quite complex and muddy and competitive and argumentative, and people tend to not be too comfortable with that. So if you can be comfortable with complexity, then you're okay with our system, and perhaps that's the design and that's the way we like it. So I think, you know, in theory, it looks a little more simple than it actually is in practice, and practice changes constantly. So that's the fascinating aspect of teaching this course.
And you don't find that your students are totally turned off by politics after learning about how this all
no,
works?
No, in fact, we're fortunate in that lots of our students go on and major in political science, so that's exciting.
So they could see Michael Hanahan then. Yeah,
absolutely. I have a student down there at UMass Amherst now.
Hank Eaton teaches Advanced Placement Government and Politics at St. Johnsbury Academy. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Michael Hanahan is a lecturer of political science at UMass Amherst. He's also the director of the UMass Civic Initiative. Michael, thank you very much for talking with us as well.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, we're not quite ready to leave politics. We'll be joined by VPR's Kathleen Masterson, who's in Iowa today. And then we will cleanse the palate with a performance by the John Daly Trio in our Live from the Fort series. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As you well know, today is caucus day in Iowa. At 7 o'clock local time, Iowans will report to their local voting precinct and make their preferences known in the first contest of the presidential nominating season. VPR's Kathleen Masterson is in Des Moines, Iowa, following the close race for the Democratic presidential nomination between Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And she joins us now. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Jane. Good to be here.
I'm glad you're here. Okay, so let's jump right in. Hillary Clinton is leading in a major poll released on Saturday, but only by 3 percentage points. What's it going to come down to decide the winner?
Well, as the campaign organizers well know, it's really coming down to turnout, right? And a big part of that is organization. Who can get to their supporters and not just have them post on Facebook, but have them actually show up at caucus night? For those who don't know, the Democratic caucus is a two-hour event. You have to show up, you talk with your fellow Iowans, move to different corners, and you literally have to stand in the corner of your candidate. So it's a real commitment. So it's going to come down to who can turn out, who can get the most supporters to show up. And it also comes down to geography, right? Even if, for example, Bernie Sanders were to win some of the bigger precincts, he could do well in some with college students, for example, like Des Moines, Iowa City. He could still lose to Hillary if the overall delegate count goes to her, if she wins some of the more rural regions. So that's why the Get Out the Caucus push is just so big right now.
And the weather, is that going to make it difficult tonight? You know what the forecast is?
I should check. It's been unusually warm, and today it's looking pretty good. Tomorrow, I'm guessing there are going to be a lot of journalists trapped in Des Moines because there is supposed to be snow. But for caucus, it looks pretty clear.
All right. I'll help you write. Kathleen, you've been there all weekend, and you've been watching the Sanders Get Out to Caucus efforts. What have you actually been seeing happening?
Sure. There's been a lot of going door to door, and they're really targeted now. They're trying to go to Sanders supporters' houses, remind, coax, cajole people to actually show up. I've seen some groups that are actually organizing nonpartisan babysitting events at churches to just say, we really want you to come out and caucus. If you can't find childcare for 2 hours, here's some free childcare. For example, I went out with Eric Marsh on Saturday. He drove down from Wisconsin to canvass for Bernie Sanders. There were still a lot of closed doors. Iowans have been pretty sick of all the ads and campaigning, but you know, they're still enthused and ready to get out and vote. So he had some interesting interactions with people in suburban Des Moines.
I'm with the Bernie Sanders campaign. Are you planning on caucusing on Monday?
Oh, we are.
Who are you planning on supporting?
John Kasich.
Oh, you're going for Kasich?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Any way we could get you to come over to Bernie?
No, I mean, I love everything that he's doing. It sounds good, but I wish for a world like that, but it's not the right time.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
So Eric wasn't able to convince that person. He did get a few feel the burn and shared some information on where people can caucus. But it's definitely a mixed bag. Even those houses that had expressed interest in Sanders, some people had, interestingly, some people were going to vote Republican were also considering Sanders. So they're definitely making a big push door to door, but it's really hard to tell what that's going to look like in terms of turnout.
Well, what about those volunteers who are doing that door-to-door push and who are really enthusiastic, we keep hearing, for Bernie Sanders? You've run into volunteers from all over the country. Do you get the sense that they really think he's electable?
Yeah, you know, the supporters really do. They're really pushing for this, and they really believe in Bernie. And one guy drove 14 hours overnight from Arizona to go door to door. So the dedication there is real. But electability is definitely a concern for Iowa voters. That's some of what we've been hearing at rallies and events and door to door. Is some voters are concerned that they like Bernie's ideas, but they want someone who can definitely get elected and actually get his or her ideas through. But one Bernie supporter I spoke to, Nicholas Moran, came from Iowa to New York. He'd recently finished grad school, so he had the time to volunteer. And he said that message was really frustrating for him. And he thought if people believed in Bernie, that they should vote for Senator Sanders.
We always have this tendency to not vote for who we want to because we're so deathly afraid of Republicans winning or whatever. I've met a lot of people and I know a lot of people who vote that way, and I just think if people vote for who the best candidate, then we'll have the best candidate. And so there's a reason why you think that person's the best candidate, so you can convince other people that they're the best candidate.
And Nicholas Moran, he was volunteering out of the CWA 7102. So he was going door to door for pretty much 2 days straight, dawn until dark is what he told me. And, you know, it will be determined if that ends up working. A quick stat that in 2008, 57% of support for Barack Obama actually came from first-time caucusers. So the Sanders campaign is really trying to replicate that. Polls don't suggest they'll get that high, but they really are trying to turn out as many people as they can, especially people who may not have voted before but are enthused by Sanders' message.
Well, what about social media? You're talking about door-to-door knocking, but what does social media do to play into the campaign's attempt to sort of gather that enthusiasm and get people to show up?
It's a great question. No one really knows, you know, if social media is going to translate into votes. There's been a lot of efforts on Facebook. Sanders has a big supporters on Reddit that have been encouraging people to do phone banks. You know, a lot of volunteers told me, oh, I'm talking to people who didn't know I could do a phone bank from my own home. So they're sending out information on how to make calls. So there's definitely organizing happening on social media. I talked to another woman who's a big Sanders supporter, and she sort of self-admitted to me that she calls herself a Slacktivist. She's been posting a lot on Facebook, but she hasn't had time to do a lot of the in-person events. Though, to be fair, I did meet her at a rally. So, you know, it's a big question that remains if this is going to turn out, if social media is going to turn out the votes. And I asked that question of political science professor Rachel Payne Caulfield. She's at Drake University in Des Moines, and she wasn't sure either.
We've never seen social media emerge in a caucus campaign the way it has in 2016. And that's partially just because social media didn't exist to this extent in 2008. So the idea that campaigns can communicate now easily and quickly across different precincts while the caucuses are happening, I think that's fascinating. But we don't know how effective social media really is at turning people out to caucus.
Yeah, and Rachel Payne Caulfield there also mentioned that social media could be used to communicate between precincts. If one region really needs to get out more voters for Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, they could try to communicate with social media. She just doesn't know what that's going to look like yet.
Kathleen, we just have a minute left, but I understand there's a big effort to mobilize Latino voters, and you've been following up on some of that effort to get Latino voters out tonight. What's the message, and why is this such a push?
Sure. You know, Latino voters haven't traditionally been a very big part of the Iowa vote, but there are about 50,000 Latinos registered to vote, and some of the leagues here are shooting to get about 10,000 people to caucus. Fred Trujillo works with the League of United Latin American Citizens of Iowa, and he felt it's so important to be politically engaged because his father didn't speak English very well, and that really kept his father from engaging in politics. So he had a conversation with a voter trying to get that person to come out to caucus.
Hola, Mr. Castellano.
Yes.
Richard here. I'm with LULAC. It's the League of United Latinos of America. And we're just wanting to make sure everybody knows about the caucus on Monday night. And it's going to be at Weeks Junior High. Can you cast a ballot there?
I never get involved in that. Okay. I just vote when it's time to vote. Yeah.
Okay. How about your wife?
She's not here right now. I don't know if she does run or not.
Oh, okay. Okay. Brother. Well, pleasure meeting you. Sure like to convince you to come up. It's the only way you can get your candidate on the ballot.
All right. So Kathleen Masterson there finding out all about how the Get Out the Caucus efforts are going here in Iowa ahead of the vote. Kathleen Masterson in Des Moines, Iowa. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Jane.
And we're going to hear more from Kathleen tonight on VPR's live coverage starting at 9 p.m. For the past year and a half, VPR has been inviting great local bands to record sessions in our performance studio for our Live from the Fort music video series. Today, we highlight the John Daly Trio. 7 Days music critic Dan Bowles says the band's songs are modest and straightforward and called their debut CD a quiet charmer. The band consists of John Daly on guitar and vocals, Adam Tarmy on bass, and Dennis Derryberry on guitar and vocals. This is the John Daly Trio performing Lost.
There was a time I turned over every rock I could. Borderline obsession to get the piece to fit. I would be lost without you. I would be lost without you. I would be lost without you. And you said, it's not too late, it never is for love. The truth be told, this loneliness just isn't what it was. Oh, it was. I would be lost without you. I would be lost without you. I would be lost without you. Like your father's ring, left sitting right where it was dropped. They can take everything, still got my guitar. I would be lost without you. I would be lost without you. I would be lost without you. Thank you.
would be lost without you.
That's the John Daly Trio performing Lost in our Live from the Fort music video series. Go to VPR.net and click on Live from the Fort to explore more of their music and to watch the performances of other great Vermont bands. VPR and NPR will have live coverage of the Iowa caucuses tonight. Tune in to VPR at 9 o'clock for the first results and for ongoing coverage all evening. And tomorrow, this show is going to New Hampshire. We'll be broadcasting live from the Dartmouth campus in Hanover to take stock of the results from the caucuses and to look ahead to the New Hampshire primary. So send your comments or questions to Vermont Edition and join us tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.